Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunting you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Obain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Now, on today's episode, we have got on a primary care physician who specializes in functional medicine, and this is Dr. Sam White. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Zuby. Really great to be here with you today to tell you what's been going on, really.
No doubt, man. Happy to have you on. So, Sam, I've done a real brief intro there, but for people who are not familiar with who you are and what you do, tell them a little bit about you.
So I've been a doctor for just over 17 years. Combination, I think, of wanting to go into medicine came about because, you know, my mom was a nurse, my dad was in the ambulance service, and I watched far too many ER episodes as a teenager and wanted to be Dr. Carter. So there I was going off to medical school. Last 11 years, I've been essentially in as a primary care physician in the community, also doing a bit of emergency work and in a palliative care hospice. I think you could probably say that the last 5 years, I've felt a realization that medicine had become too much about a pill for an ill. You'd be, as a GP in this country, seeing about 40 patients a day. There wasn't time to care, really. There wasn't time to look at the root cause. And that's when I, you know, began training and things into functional medicine, which is a lot more popular in the States and well known in the States than here. But it seeks to look at the underlying root cause of what's going on, what might be causing that, and potentially reversing it rather than just covering it with medication. Mm. Now, I guess like a lot of people listening, when it was first announced that there was going to be a pandemic, we were expecting the worst thing we'd ever seen in our careers. But my initial experience with COVID-19 early on led me to kind of go down the rabbit hole and find out what's really going on here. And essentially none of the measures that were introduced by the UK government through their heinous Coronavirus Act or around the world have any justification in medicine. Certainly not in medical ethics and not in the scientific consensus, really, when you dig a bit deeper. And I got to the point in December where I said to my colleagues, I don't want any part of this vaccine schedule. You cannot justify an experiment, and you never, ever experiment on human beings, certainly never children. You cannot justify that when there are known effective treatments out there that are safe. And to do so, knowing the results of previous experiments with coronavirus vaccines, was just, I think in time that would be considered unlawful. And we'll look back at this period in history and realize it was one of the worst in history. But by the new year, I decided that was it. I'd said in writing to the NHS and by default, the General Medical Council, if this happens, I'm going. And that's what I did. That wasn't a problem really for anyone in the health service who'd read what I'd written down until a video of mine somewhat accidentally, because I wasn't, you know, I didn't have a lot of followers on social media or anything. I was quite enjoyed keeping myself to myself, really. Went viral, and I think it was over a million views before being deleted, you know, by social media. And that was only a few minutes long, but that got me into a lot of trouble very quickly.
Okay. Well, yeah. there's a lot to touch on here.
Yeah.
So first of all, why do you call this rollout an experiment? I'm sure there's going to be some people who are listening to this. Of course, we're going to have people on all different sides of this issue and of this conversation. But what makes you use that term, an experiment?
Well, that's what it is. We know that these are still essentially in phase three clinical trials, and that various stages of the trial process were merged together. And they've skipped the part particularly important where you do animal studies first. I don't like the idea of experimenting on animals very much. Again, we've got treatments. We didn't need to experiment on animals either. But we already had the results of the SARS-CoV-1 trials in animals, which were enough, because they were horrendous results, to say, we shouldn't do this. There's never been a successful coronavirus vaccine.
What were the results in those animal trials?
So there's a phenomenon in medicine called antibody-dependent enhancement. And with animal studies, you're allowed to go, from an ethical point of view, that one stage further. So you can inoculate the animals, they used ferrets, with the vaccine, and then expose them to the virus. And essentially what the antibody dependent enhancement means, that they're going to go on to get a worse form of the infection when they're re-exposed to it than they would have done had they not been vaccinated. And of course, you see around the world that the countries with highest vaccination rates are having some of the worst outcomes as well. And you have to wonder if that is a large contributory factor.
Okay. Is that specifically true when you say that they're having some of the worst outcomes? What precisely do you mean by that?
Well, the UK is very heavily vaccinated, and in the majority of the admissions with what they're calling breakthrough cases of COVID are actually in the vaccinated individuals. Same in Israel. Taiwan, I think it's more people have died from the vaccine than have had, you know, COVID-19 and died of that. So you saw a vast difference. I found the US really fascinating. So there's vast difference, you know, Florida and Texas, for instance, where they've stopped doing this testing, stopped mask wearing, because it's so multi-layered, the medical and non-medical approaches to this, that I pretty much find fault with every aspect of it. And, you know, the mainstream media will go after me for being the masks do nothing doctor, you know, and I stand by that.
I hear that. But I'm still curious about this point of the outcomes, because I have my questions and my skepticism around various aspects of it, but it doesn't necessarily seem to be the case that places with, I mean, I think in terms of infection rates, I'm not really seeing much of a thing, but I've always thought, and I was saying this from last year, that the whole case thing to me seems a little bit pointless. I think it's about hospitalizations, deaths, you know, really negative outcomes. That's the thing people are concerned with. As far as I'm concerned, if case numbers are going up but deaths are not, that's actually a good thing, because it means more people are getting natural immunity over the course of time, and then you can actually get some form of natural herd immunity, as far as I understand it.
Yeah.
But I think that what I've seen is that with a lot of these policies, certainly with the lockdowns and the mask mandates, is that there does not seem to be any strong correlation between those and hospitalization rates, death rates, etc. Some people might be listening to this and they'll say, no, you're wrong, but I challenge anyone to show me a strong correlation. You brought up the USA. I mean, you can look state to state. You can look at the numbers there. You can look at the data. And I don't see any any correlation. That's been the position since last year. I don't know if it's changed, if it's updated, but I'm yet to see that. I mean, of course, you can always cherry pick to prove, you can take one area and try to prove something off that. But if you look at it as a whole, I don't see much. So what do you think is going on with the whole mask situation? Because you've obviously vocally spoken out about that. Yeah. It's strange how it's become such a controversial topic, but everything is these days. I think 2 years into the situation, if masks were highly effective, I don't think it would really be debatable whether or not I support a mandate. I'd think that the efficacy would be very obvious by now. And it certainly does not seem to be, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, in actual fact, there was a study done with the first SARS virus, the Amoy Gardens one. And the reason I said from the outset, and I wouldn't walk around with a mask and I still don't, that masks don't work to stop the spread, is because you're dealing with something that's primary mode of spread is through aerosols. So the mask is not going to stop aerosols. The purpose of a mask, certainly not cloth masks and even the surgical masks that you see people wearing, the purpose is when you have a surgeon, for instance, who's operating over a sterile environment. Remember, the mask isn't the sterile part when he gets scrubbed, puts that on first and then scrubs usually. He's operating standing still in a well-ventilated theater into what is potentially an open body cavity. So if he sneezes or coughs, that mask will stop, should do, the spread of mucus, okay? But not aerosols. If he's got an active respiratory infection, that's going to do nothing. And all it's going to do potentially is nebulize those aerosols into smaller particles, and those will hang around in the air even longer. Now, there was a study even done in the 80s, and it was in the UK, and a consultant surgeon had no one, including himself, wear a mask for 6 months. And it was quite interesting because he found that in doing so, his post-operative infection rate, so complications after surgery from infection, halved in that period. Mm. And that was never really followed up on, because obviously the standard protocol is that you wear a mask in theatre. Mm-hmm. Of course, but doing so as a surgeon in theatre, not moving around, being well ventilated, is quite different from someone who's working 12 hours as a shift in a warehouse, driving a truck, walking around town, because what you're doing then is creating this focus of moisture, germs, viruses, bacteria, which you're going to then re-inhale. Okay. You're also going to be rebreathing carbon dioxide even more, okay? And that, there's something recognized as dentist mouth as well, as a complication they get from mask wearing. But you have the potential there, if you've got a more acidic environment and carbon dioxide retention, to actually lower the pH in the mouth. And I think our dental colleagues in a few years or a year or two will be pulling out a lot more teeth as a result, sadly. But you've really then got this dense concentration of harmful material on a mask that you're rebreathing along with CO2. Now, the studies that have been done in children are absolutely damning when it comes to face masks. And there's a very good site, which is probably going to be a part of the new age of medicine, called the World Council for Health, if people want to go and have a look. They put all the research there nicely for you about the harms in children, because the harms in children are such that they're retaining carbon dioxide much quicker than adults. If you're a six-year-old, your brain is still growing, it's still developing. It has a remarkable ability to learn. You've got neuroplasticity. That's going to have a very detrimental effect on a child's development. And that's before you even get onto the psychological harm and the shaming that goes with wearing a mask, I think. There's some very, it has a lot of historical context, wearing a mask, that's not something we should ever be proud about or ever want to revisit at all. And that's what people have done. And you've got this, it's all part of this psychological warfare that's been done by people. And there's no justification for it at all, whatsoever, from a medical point of view. I'm not an expert. I couldn't go into a courtroom as an expert witness. I'm a regular doctor. I see patients. But this has no basis in medicine whatsoever, treating people the way they've been treated. And using what I resented the most, Subi, was the fact that my profession, the one I loved, the one I went into because I loved, was the means of orchestrating this, frankly, tyranny. Okay. Because if you've quarantined, for instance, that's about keeping people separate who have a highly contagious and serious illness. Locking up perfectly healthy people, destroying their livelihoods, their careers, their ability to get vitamin D, even, or exercise, that's tyrannical. And there's no place in our society and in our world.
That's crazy. Yeah, it's crazy. First question is, in your 17 years of medicine, I mean, have you ever seen anything comparable to this?
No. Yeah. I was perhaps like we all were, just going with the flow. And I planned this kind of gradual transition into more holistic medicine. But we were led to believe, and the mortality figures were predicted to be much higher than they ever were or ever turned out to be. We were led to believe this was going to be the worst thing we'd ever seen. And you would have seen as well, like a lot of your listeners, they were making these Nightingale hospitals in the UK, you know, suddenly getting the army in to construct these makeshift hospitals with ventilators as well. And we were bracing for something really, really serious. And at first I thought, that's fine, you know, I'll step up to the plate. I've never been in a pandemic before. It's not going to happen again in my lifetime, I doubt. And I don't know if I told you, but we set up like a community hub for people with suspected COVID. That was before there was any testing that, you know, it's been abolished by the CDC, of course. But the first time I went there was Good Friday last year. So it's just as we're coming into spring in England. The roads are empty. People are at home. They're not at work. And the clinic was empty. I didn't see a single patient. So that's when I started to think something's not right here. You could maybe dismiss it as, well, maybe they haven't got to the south coast of England yet. Or maybe it's regional. But the second time I went there, I didn't see a single patient who had respiratory symptoms. Now, bear in mind, this was a dedicated unit for seeing people with possible COVID. But people were getting referred on the basis of they might have a temperature. Okay, and it's a little bit like how the trials went. I don't know if you looked at them. But when they came out with this 95% efficacy for Pfizer, I think that's pretty incredible. But the endpoint markers in those trials were one symptom, so a cough, sore throats, a fever, and a positive PCR. Well, I'm sure we'll get on to testing as well, but one symptom and a positive PCR does not a COVID case make. And yet, that's how they eventually got to this figure, or very quickly actually got to this figure, that everyone thought this was going to be, well, I didn't, but patients were led to believe that this was going to be so effective for them.
So during the height of this, especially prior to any vaccination rollout, how bad did it actually get? As a doctor who was out there seeing patients, how bad did it get? Because this is something that I hear very mixed stories about. I know different doctors in different hospitals in different parts of the world and in different cities. And my understanding is that in some places and at certain times, the hospitals did genuinely get overwhelmed or were close to being so. And then at other times or in other hospitals, stuff was pretty normal and pretty quiet. Is that accurate? Or what was it that you saw yourself?
So I wasn't working in hospital, but I had friends that did. And initially, for the first 2 months in our area, the local hospitals were pretty empty. And one of my friends in the emergency department said, "We're waiting for these COVID patients, but they haven't turned up." Plus, you had in England this additional thing where people were advised by the government to stay at home. So you had all these people who had non-COVID related things, perhaps not coming to hospital. Mm. And that is going to have a serious effect both in hospital and in the community, where, for instance, 70% of cancers would be picked up in the community. So we weren't doing that. I took my leave in, handed in my notice and pretty much went straight away. I didn't work the notice period in February time. And it had been a fairly normal winter as far as I know. Now, as you probably know, certainly in the UK, there were no excess deaths in 2020. But we are seeing that now from non-COVID causes.
Mm.
So particularly in the under 65 age group, we're seeing a rise in heart attacks, strokes, and what's called other circulatory diseases,
mm-hmm.
which was one of the fears with using this very atypical vaccine. And I don't like to be calling it a vaccine. This is a gene-based therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be controversial there, but
that's what it is called.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it actually is called. I know that term upsets or angers people,
yeah.
But that's literally what it is.
Yeah, it's on the Moderna website, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And in our, when I got in trouble, that was one of the things they didn't like me saying that. But again, if you want to let's take a basic definition of what a vaccine is and should be kind of internationally recognized. Well, it should give you at least as a bare minimum 50% coverage for the various viral strains. Should last a year at least. But with Pfizer alone, you've got 6 months of antibodies. Now, the real elephant in the room, which has never been considered here in the UK, and which we're going to do when we get our judicial review to challenge the travel rules, is introduce the idea of natural immunity. So there's people who had SARS-CoV-1 early on in the century. They've still got immunity now, 18 years later. So, well, what's going on there? They might have people might have an antibody test and that doesn't come up positive. Well, that's when it's then stored as the memory T cells. So you have a T cell test, and that will be what's called reactive. And the other issue when we talk about natural immunity is we know now that people who have naturally acquired immunity are more likely to suffer a side effect, complication from the vaccine. So why on earth would we be mandating without testing people first?
Yes.
Prior exposure, prior infection. And their immunity, they've done everyone else who's vaccinated a favor, because their own immunity is broad in coverage,
it's
long lasting.
Mm-hmm.
And the current gene-based therapies, they're not only not fit for human use, but they're obsolete in terms of their coverage for the variants.
Mm.
We saw that largely with the so-called Delta variant as well.
Mm-hmm. And then with this new one, I mean, the majority of people getting it and spreading it are, of course, people who have had the injections. That's just a fact.
Exactly. And I think actually it's probably a bit of a design flaw at the very best in the vaccine. So if you inject something into someone's deltoid, they were saying early on that this would stay in the deltoid. Well, it doesn't do that, unfortunately. This toxin goes to other organs in the body. The Japanese, you probably know, did a study to see where in the body it was going.
When you say toxin, why are you calling it a toxin?
When people get sick from SARS-CoV-2, particularly at the later stages when they're throwing off blood clots and their oxygen levels are plummeting because of, you know, blood clots, that's because of this spike protein, okay? And that has an affinity for receptors in the body called ACE2, and it will bind there. And anywhere in the body where that spike protein might go and those receptors might be, it will cause an immune-mediated reaction. So that's why we're potentially seeing a lot of women, for instance, the incredible number of women that I speak to now with menstrual irregularities. You know, period is a very, very healthy indicator of how well a woman is, you know, how good is your sort of body clock like that. And we're seeing these, and, you know, we're seeing, you know, stillbirths, a rise in late stage miscarriage.
Are there any numbers on that? I know it's hard to find this information because you hear things and, you know, especially anecdotally, or, you know, this happened to a friend or this happened to a friend's friend. Mm-hmm. But what is there a database that's actually listing these and has these numbers and statistics?
Yeah. And that actually speaks to my first point about the biggest experiment ever, because you had pre-existing databases. We call it the yellow card system in the UK. You've got VAERS in the US and the Euro monitoring system also. But you had these systems which were never robust enough, I don't think, to pick up everything in terms of what was going on, considering that this is still in clinical trial. Okay. And there was a Harvard study in 2009 which looked at VAERS and considered as a conclusion that there might be some huge underreporting in the VAERS data. And potentially that was only showing you about 1% of adverse events and outcomes. Now, that's quite acceptable, you would say, if someone gets a little rash after taking a medication. They might not report it. The doctor might not report it. You're meant to as a doctor. It's a clinical responsibility. But you can see why those minor things would not be. Mm-hmm. Now, what we've got and what you'll see shortly published is data looking at these various reporting systems that goes into a bit more detail and breaks it down. But also you're able to see some quite clear trends. I can't say more at the moment because it's not quite released yet from my sort of side on the legal team. Mm-hmm. But it is, what I will say is that it's shocking, terrifying, actually, what we found. And we've had some real experts go over the data and look at that. But when you think about what's happening with these injections, if you have an ordinary vaccine, for instance, what you've got is usually the whole virus that's been deadened or weakened. But what they've done here is take just one protein out of about 27 others and ask your body to continue to go on making it. Now, something that I do in functional medicine is, say I'm looking for the root cause of someone who's got an autoimmune condition, I want to look for a protein or bacteria or a virus that could have triggered that immune reaction. And back last year, I was looking at these mRNA gene therapies and thinking, hang on a minute, that looks like how you would define an autoimmune disease. It's incredible. And put that together.
What do you mean by that?
So you've got this foreign body protein circulating in the body. And I think it was highly naive at best to think that it would just stay in the arm, because it doesn't, clearly doesn't. That's going to cause an immune response. So your own body is then going to attack and mount an immune response to wherever that protein goes, which is very similar process to what identical, really, to what happens in autoimmune disease. So things like rheumatoids, Sjogren's, you know, MS even, those sorts of things. So it just didn't make any sense from even a theoretical point of view to me as a clinician looking at that.
I was going to say, why is it that, so you now are in this state where you're considered, and certainly in the media, you're looked at as some kind of rogue doctor almost. But yeah. what about your colleagues? What about the other doctors, the other nurses, the other people involved in healthcare throughout all this? Why is it, were there other people who also stepped away from all of this, or was it just yourself?
Not that I know of, so much in the UK. No friends of mine, for instance. And you know, I'd be lying to say if life hasn't been difficult for me as a result of mm-hmm. what I've done, because that video pretty much set fire to my career, and I was, as you know, suspended by two organizations. I thought there might be some blowback. I didn't realize the opposing team was playing from the Rules for Radicals, Saul Alinsky book, you know, where the immediate response was not to consider any of the evidence I had or what I was talking about. Because bear in mind, Ziba, I'd written this all down for the GMC and the NHS the year before.
Okay.
In a lot of detail. Mm-hmm. And they'd actually just issued me my re-license for another 5 years, because that happens every 5 years for us doctors. After having read that, the very same guy who read and approved that for the general, on behalf of the General Medical Council, was the guy who a couple of months later was suspending me.
That's interesting.
Exactly. And I'm getting a phone call to tell me that they're concerned about my welfare and my health. And thankfully I had my dictaphone to hand, so I was able to record this, because, you know, this woman, a senior clinical advisor at NHS England, so a physician also, was telling me this, having seen my social media. It's very clear that I'm not physically incapacitated such that I couldn't be a doctor or a GP or anything. And it's very obvious what she's alluding to. And I was then going to be made, which I was, an example of, so everyone else was fearful of coming forward. So getting true numbers for that in the UK, I think, is really hard. What I've noticed, and I'm part of international doctors' groups, obviously meeting online and for some time, is that there's more obvious ability to dissent, if you like, in other places in the world. The Commonwealth countries, doctors from the Commonwealth countries seem to be the worst affected in terms of how they're treated. But there is a large consensus and among experts. I mean, I'm basically, when I go to these meetings, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, really, you know, absolute experts, legends in medicine and in their fields of expertise. Mm-hmm. And it's a real privilege for someone like me to be there with them. But they're saying the same things as me, you know. But I think in the UK in particular, people would be very fearful about coming forward. And part of me going to the High Court was to pave the way to make it clear for other doctors and nurses to come forward, with the peace of mind of knowing that their concerns would actually be investigated and looked into. Mm-hmm. And that's actually something that the Royal College of General Practitioners said just in 2018. Because if people think that the health service, because we all love it, is not capable of systemic failure, it's happened before. It happened in Staffordshire in England, where there were a large number of unexpected deaths. And one of the people that called that out, they did the same thing. And then in 2018, the Royal College GPs published an article which says that whistleblowers should be protected and encouraged to come forward. Because if you have got systemic failings in any system, you need to know about it so you can fix it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And put a stop to it.
Absolutely. What was it specifically that made you take such a stance? Because I'm always intrigued when there's the exception. Like, I can understand it from my perspective, and I imagine if I were a doctor, I would have done the same thing if I saw what you were seeing. But what is it, do you think, that makes you the exception there? What is it either within you or specifically that you saw that made you go, you know what, I cannot stand in silence? Because that's what most people do. That's always the problem, right? The problem is not some great evil out there. The problem is always that the problem is what people do in the face of when they see something that they believe is wrong, especially if it threatens their livelihood, their job, comfort, their social status, all of these things. Very few people are willing to sacrifice any of these things to any degree or to even put them at risk. But in your case, you put that out there, right? You put that out there. 99% of people wouldn't. So why did you?
I think there's a spiritual element to this as well for me personally. I was raised as a fairly strict Catholic, but I didn't, by the time I got to medical school, I didn't really see the virtue in the Vatican or the Catholic Church. And for a long time, I went down this, I'm a scientist, so therefore I'm an atheist, and reading sort of Richard Dawkins and things. But I think over the last couple of years, I've come back to God. So there is I have come back to God. There's no question there. Just not religion, just not monotheism, as I would say.
Okay.
And I think for me, something kicked in last year, and I can't quite answer that fully about what changed in me. And I can only think that was a little bit of a calling, perhaps, for me to do something here. I had a recurring thought in my mind last December. And I actually was thinking that it would never happen. They would never bring this out onto the market and expect us to be involved with it. But they did, because I was thinking that other doctors would say, we're not doing it. And if enough doctors did that, it never would have happened. And that didn't happen, much to my surprise. It went ahead anyway. And it didn't matter
what specifically are you referring to here?
That was when in December last year, that was when the first vaccines were rolled out.
Okay.
To the frail elderly who had not been included in any trials, those that are on many medications.
So you were surprised by this rollout? You thought that doctors would say no?
Yeah, I thought every doctor, nearly as a primary care doctor, would say we're not doing this.
Okay. What made you think that would be the case?
Because the evidence beforehand was so damning that we couldn't proceed with such haste.
Which evidence are you referring to specifically here?
Even if you take just those first trials, okay, and then you've got this, I mean, there's lots of things to do with the way the vaccine works, but to knowingly continue to suppress proven safe therapeutics. And when, for instance, Dr. Tess Laurie at the Independent Research Consortium did a really thorough meta-analysis on ivermectin, she realized that some of the ivermectin trials had to be stopped early. Okay. Now, why was that? That was due to ethical concern. It was deemed unethical by the doctors conducting the trial to continue to hold a control group, i.e. an untreated group, because they were doing so much poorly compared with the treated group.
That's interesting.
So that these physicians said, this is too unethical for us to continue the trial. We've got to give everyone ivermectin.
Where was this study done?
These are a few of these, actually. Okay. Yeah. And that's
because the studies I heard about were ones where I think they gave it too late in the game for it to be. So those ones were sort of neutral. Those weren't ones that it was harmful, but just that it's inconclusive, it's neutral. But my understanding is in those cases, they gave it way too late in the game. That's what I understand.
Exactly. I like to break it down into three stages of this illness. So you have the initial infection and replication of the virus. That's when you want early intervention in the community to stop that viral replication. If you don't, you're going to get inflammation. And then the third stage, is when people are developing blood clots. And that's potentially when they're getting short of breath and their oxygen level is dipping. Now, in the UK, as you probably realized, if you have a positive PCR and you're unwell, there's nothing, caveat that with saying there is now the steroid inhaler, budesonide, only for the over 50s. And it was sneaked onto the guidelines in April 21 without a big fanfare or a government press conference. So I don't know that many people know about it. Certainly the lady who called me from NHS England to tell me I was crazy didn't know about it. So she asked me was, because I'd mentioned in my video three medications, she wanted to ask me about HCQ. So you can't talk about HCQ because that, despite hundreds of papers on that, the effectiveness, despite Fauci writing a paper. Yeah,
this video is not going to be able to go on YouTube, by the way. So this is good. This one's going to be exclusive to the audio podcast, and I'll try to get the video on Odyssey or Rumble as well, because I already know I can't put this on YouTube.
That's probably why I haven't been invited back on mainstream media, isn't it?
Yeah, you can't. It's officially violated their policy.
Has it?
If I put this on my channel, it's going to get a strike, so I can't do it. And that also shows how crazy.
Yeah.
Right. That shows how crazy things have become. Right. And
run
how. Yeah, and I was going to say how anti-scientific it all is. I mean, science is based on inquiry. It's based on questioning. It's based on challenges. It's based on putting forward ideas and challenging them. But we're operating in this very bizarre realm that I've never seen in my life before, certainly not with any disease or with any treatment, where I was going to say that it's more akin to a religion, but I'd say it's more akin to a cult, because even in religion, you could ask questions. With what's going on here, there's just one narrative, stick with it. No questions, no other treatments can be discussed. Nothing outside of the beloved injection can be discussed. And you're not even supposed to call it an injection. You're not even meant to call it a gene therapy, or you're supposed to call it by its holy name. It's very, very bizarre, man. I've just never seen anything like this before, but carry on.
I don't think we ever expected to either, ZB. I mean, yeah. Hopefully we never will again. That's all I can say. See something like this.
What are your thoughts on, maybe we'll get to this, but what are your thoughts on this booster program? Because it sounds like they're now trying to get people on three or four shots a year. I mean, here in the UK, Sajid Javid just the other day was saying that, you know, every 3 months people should be getting boosters. So what are your thoughts on that?
That should be a real awakening for people that actually these jabs are not nearly as effective as they first made out. And if your antibodies are lasting only 6 months and they want to boost you every few months, you know, you've got to start asking questions. Now, some of us would have thought when they imposed a lockdown, for instance, and then started to build this narrative towards the end of last year that if you have a vaccine, you'll get your freedom back. Grandparents will be able to finally go and see their grandchildren.
Get your freedom back. It's such an oxymoron. That's so it's so Orwellian that you have to take an injection to get your freedom. It's like, well, then you're not free.
No.
You're not free.
And they never had the right to ever take it. That's the key thing. So if you think, or you're deceived, because this is a time of great deception, now more than ever, we need to exercise perception, really. If you think that you are going to get your freedom back, then you should realize they never should have taken it in the first place. And these people, if you allow them to do that...
Well, they never did take it. I think this is an important point, which is that they never did take it because your freedoms are not granted by the government, right? It's in your own mind. Yeah. People whose freedom was taken away, it's like, well, that my freedom was never taken away, right? it was infringed upon in certain areas, but I'm a free man. I'm a free person. You can't take that from me unless you're going to physically come and throw me in a cell or something. In which case it's still simply being infringed upon. But I think too many people have this notion, and really it's a more of a philosophical idea, that their rights and their freedoms directly come from the government, and as such, they can grant them and repeal them as they wish. And I'm always telling people, I'm like, no, that's not how it works. Your rights can be infringed upon, your freedom can be infringed upon, but they can't be granted. Like, you are a free human being. That's your birthright. Like, that's your God-given right. Yeah. So this whole stuff of like, oh, we do this and we can get our freedom back, I reject that outright.
No. And one of the things I said in my video was, please don't have this because you think you can go on holiday. Because again, that's about me saying, you know, none of this has ever been about medicine. And I would sometimes ask people in January when I was still there, why did you have this? You know, in your 50s. And they would have had a bad reaction. I mean, why do you have? Oh, well, I like going on holiday. That's not a medical reason. That's never going to be a medical reason. And don't think that just because you've had it that you will be allowed to go on holiday by the government's rules and mandates.
Do you know why it's also weird? Is that you've never needed it to go on holiday.
No.
Right? Like, this is the weird thing is, people here's something I've noticed, is that people imagine that there are rules and restrictions that don't exist. This is something I've noticed this whole time, because over the past 18 months, I've been to 7 countries. And every day people are like, how are you traveling? How are you doing this? And I'm like, bro, like, you've been able to travel pretty much this whole time. There was a short period in the UK early at the beginning of this year where, like, they made it very hard for you to travel. But outside of that, in vast majority of countries, exceptions being perhaps like Australia, New Zealand, you've been able to travel throughout this whole time. There might be a couple hoops to jump through, or you might need a negative test or something, but people are like really locked in this mental prison and they haven't bothered to even do the most basic, like, there's people who 2 years in, they don't even know that, oh, like, I could have traveled. Like, they didn't even know. Like, it's weird. Yeah, there are restrictions, but then people create new ones in their own brain, and I don't know, so many people are stuck in this strange mental prison. It's very, very bizarre to me.
I think that partly comes with being reliant on the government for your what seems like your health, your welfare. I don't mean that in terms of benefit payments. I mean this kind of illusion that the government is there to protect you and keep you safe. I'm pretty sure after all this, we'll agree, all of us, when it all comes out, and it will, the government was never really set up to care about the people. And you got to live your life. So long as you don't cause harm or wrong to anyone else, You're not breaking any laws that I know of, you know, in terms of common law, natural law, God's law. Mm-hmm. That's what the actual law of living men and women is, of course. And
absolutely.
Unfortunately, that's a huge rabbit hole to go down, and it goes back down centuries, where, you know, people who think that they have complete dominion over the earth, essentially, and they want to be God instead.
I think that's a huge problem that we're dealing with here. I think that the godlessness aspect of this is very, very deep and very, very important in terms of people's behavior and everything that's been going on. I think that a lot of people have created, like I said, a new religion / cult, and they're now adherents and advocates, and, you know, they're proselytizing it, and they want everyone to get baptized with this injection so that they can be clean and be saved. And anyone who doesn't is a heretic and a blasphemer. And in fact, some of the people are outright saying that they should be punished, right? Mm-hmm. They should be excommunicated. Yeah. They should be pariahs. Maybe they should even have some legal repercussions. I mean, it's truly a psychosis. It's very, I don't know, the whole thing is so unprecedented and weird to me. And it's also weird and disorienting because I flip back between everything sort of seeming normal for the most part, not everything, but mostly normal, and then things seeming totally crazy. And I think maybe it's because we're reaching a stage where I think the jig is almost up. Yeah. I think the jig is almost up. The amount of lies, this whole house of cards that they've built, and then all of the goalposts shifting and the stuff not making sense, and just the fact that, you know, people are simply not dying and getting sick in the way that the doomsayers almost want it to happen. I've made this point several times before that this is the first pandemic ever where people want the disease to be worse than it is so that they can be proved correct. Like, there's people out there who want all these unvaccinated people to get sick and drop dead. Right. You'll even see some of them openly saying it. Right. And that's because they want to be proven right. Yeah. Yeah. But then at the same time, these are the people who are claiming that everything they're doing is about selflessness and kindness and the greater good and looking out for humanity and all that. I'm like, look, regardless of whether someone's taken this shot or that shot or hasn't, or they've taken this treatment, I'm like, look, I'm pro-human. I want everybody to be as healthy as possible. I was talking about health way before it was cool. I wrote a book on health and fitness before there was any pandemic situation. Like, I've been advocating for actual health and fitness as well as liberty for a long time. And all of a sudden, and that's another thing that's crazy with all this, is how little conversation there's been around actual health. It's just been social distance, masks, and vaccines, and nothing about diet, nutrition, sleep, drinking water, supplementation, lifestyle, getting sunlight, not being socially isolated. All of these very, very important things to do with your health have been totally not just ignored, but actively discouraged, sometimes forcibly discouraged. And that's when I just look at the whole thing and I'm like, what is going on here, guys? Like, what is this whole situation?
Yeah. So this has been happening for a very, very long time. And I think it feeds into as well the destruction of family and family values as well. It's interesting you mention diet, because there was a paper published in London in the 70s, which showed that actually a higher fat diet was okay for you, healthy fats, if you like. Of course, there's key vitamins, particularly vitamin D, which has a key role in the immune system, which is absorbed as a fat-soluble vitamin. So you need to have fats. Then what did we see in the 80s? We saw this low-fat diet. You can't have butter, you've got to have margarine and things. And it ended up being very high in carbohydrate. And yet what's happened as a result of that, and this goes back to the WHO, is you have these diseases now where people run very high insulin levels because their pancreas is constantly having to deal with these insulin shots, insulin spikes from eating carbs and sugars and things, and they then get type 2 diabetes, they get obese. This has all been this explosion in the last 30 or 40 years, and it goes back to diet. And not once in a press conference have you heard them say vitamin D.
Nope. And that's, there's some simple heuristics which just make me think like the whole thing is a complete sham. And that's that there's a lot of them, but that is one of them. There's maybe like five or six things I just look at, you know, the complete ignoring of natural immunity. That's another one, right? If someone doesn't want to talk about natural immunity or downplay it or act like it doesn't even exist, I'm like, at that point, I can't trust anything you're saying about this topic in terms of actual like health and medicine. Like, this is basic GCSE biology, and you have supposed doctors and health experts who are there outright denying it, right? Outright saying that, or you know, they're brought up and they're like, well, we don't really know about that one. And I'm just like, these people are clowns, man.
Yeah. And you can see why I didn't want to be a part of it as well. Because you just can't go along with a lie like this if you've realized it, I think. And I think we are seeing more of an awakening with the public as well. But I say to people who consult with me, you know, because they'll ask, why can't other people see it? Why can't I see it? And I think it's easy, particularly if you've gone along with the vaccine, to believe this kind of easy lie that the government has told day after day throughout than a very, very difficult truth about how heinous this crime is against liberty, against all of us. And we have to come to a realization at some point in time, and I think there will be some lawful ramifications for those who perpetrated it. I have to believe
that. I hope so.
I have to believe that.
Yep.
Because we need to make sure, and this was something that's said after the Second World War. So I have patients in their 90s who are telling me this as well. You know, we agreed that this would never happen again. And yet that's where we are. You've got Ursula von der Leyen saying, well, maybe the Nuremberg Code's not so relevant anymore. You know, absolutely terrifying.
If that it's crazy, man.
If that doesn't wake you up.
Honestly.
Okay. And the Nuremberg Code is not ambiguous. It's very decisive. You've got free informed consent freely given. And again, informed consent should mean a discussion about what alternative treatments there are. And that means doing nothing as well. That means a very conservative, well, not conservative nowadays in this country, but because they're the communists now, apart from a few.
There's nothing conservative nor liberal about any of this. That's the amazing part.
Yeah. And there was never anything liberal about, you know, the Democrats in the US or the opposing bench of the Labour Party or Liberal Democrats. That's not liberty. That's not the Van Mises definition of what
liberty
is. You know, Dr. Ron Paul's version, which I happen to like very much.
Yeah.
And again, he called this out, you know, from the start.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that's not liberalism or freedom or liberty that any of us should recognize. Nowadays, it seems trendy to say you're a communist, forgetting the lessons of the last century, you know, which were horrific.
That's a whole other conversation.
My head exploded. Yeah.
But Sam, where do you think this goes next year? Where do you think we'll be this time next year?
I don't think we'll still be here, because I get asked this a lot by patients. I think there's a mass awakening. I see a silent majority rising up peacefully and coming together and saying enough. We've got more planned in terms of legal action. That's pretty much nonstop. And we have a team of dedicated warriors, if you like, who are not doing this, you know, because they love doing it. They're doing it because they're protecting the future of their grandchildren, their children, in all honesty. And we've all got to do that now.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sam, really respect what you're doing. Thank you for taking a stand and for being a man of principle. If people want to follow you or find out more about you, where's the best place for them to go?
So my website is drsamwhite.com, and I am Dr. Sam White is usually my social media handle. Interestingly, Zuby, the day I won my High Court appeal, I could no longer use Twitter. Interesting coincidence, eh?
Yeah.
But no, I've got Telegram as well. I am Dr. Sam White.
Okay. What's the best place for people to follow you if they can follow you on one?
My website and drsamwhite.com.
Okay.
But yeah, I've got a health bulletin there for people that have Zooms backstage with experts as well.
Amazing. Dr. Sam White, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been great chatting with you. And I'm sure we'll talk again.
My pleasure, Zuby. Thank you very much. Thank you. I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram. Stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam. Put some respect on my name. Sick like Obain, click and I bang. Y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name. Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.